This evening, our speaker is Brother Ron Cowie, but it's my understanding that he's asked us to have a short reading read before we begin his class, and that's Matthew 12, and it's the first 14 verses of Matthew 12, and for that, we'll have Brother Cody Houghton from the Cranston, Rhode Island Ecclesia come and read that for us.
Matthew chapter 12, the first 14 verses. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungered and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. But he said unto them, Have ye not read what David did when he was hungered and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law, how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? But I say unto you, that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And when he had departed thence, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. And they asked him, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days, that they might accuse him? And he said unto them, What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it, lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore is it lawful to do well on the Sabbath days? Then saith he to the man, Stretch forth thine hands. And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole, like as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him.
Thank you. Brothers and sisters, Brother Ron Cowie of the Enfield Ecclesia in Australia will be speaking this evening via Zoom, and his address is entitled The Lord of the Sabbath, Challenging the Legal Mind. Brother Ron.
Well, good evening, everybody. So nice to be talking to you at Midwest, even though it's only by the virtue of technology. And we send our greetings to you all, especially those of you that we've met many times before. We're going to talk this evening about the situation that existed when the Lord was on the earth. And here was the lovely Son of God healing so many people, putting before them the principles of God, curing the lepers, raising the dead in some cases, converting sinners. And yet, in the end, he seemed to be yet under so much pressure from the authorities of that time, and especially the way that they conspired to get together to destroy him and to remove him from the influence he had over the people. And we do wonder, I think, a little bit at the severity of their opposition to the Lord Jesus Christ, given the fact that he did so much good in the land. And we want to just explore this particular issue of the mindset behind the way that they kept the Sabbath. And in that reading in Matthew chapter 12 that we have this situation that arose because on a Sabbath day, as they were traveling to the synagogue, the disciples who were hungry were rubbing grains of wheat between their hands to get a little sustenance. And they were criticized by the people who were watching them, the Pharisees particularly, who were watching them, about that they were breaking the Sabbath. And we know these arguments the Lord put forward there. But I want you to notice, particularly in verse 6, that Jesus, having given an example of the fact that in the temple on days and Sabbath days, the priests were working twice as hard because the daily sacrifices were doubled, and people had more opportunity to make offerings on those days, that the priests actually had to work harder on the Sabbath. And Jesus makes that point that that in that particular case, the Sabbath was not kept as the Jews normally kept it. And so he says that in this place is one greater than the temple, and he placed himself above the temple that they revered so much. And then we come down to verse 8, and he said, for the Son of Man is Lord also, as it says in Mark, also of the Sabbath day. And so Jesus elevated himself over the way that they kept the Sabbath. And that was a tremendous challenge to the current thinking that was extant in Israel at that particular time. So we want to explore a little bit why it was that the Sabbath day became such a battle for them. Now, we must appreciate that in these Sabbath day confrontations, on the first two occasions Jesus healed people on Sabbath days, it was pretty well at home with Peter's mother-in-law the first time. The second one was in the synagogue with the man who was a demoniac. But from there on, it became a very open battle. Because on the third occasion, we have a Sabbath confrontation. It was in the synagogue at Capernaum. And it was a deliberate occasion where they set him up to try and break the Sabbath and therefore to discredit him in the eyes of the people. So this became a battleground. We need to explore why the Sabbath became such a battleground between Jesus and the Jews of his time. But I want to just first do a little digression as to appreciate how much Judaism had corrupted the laws of God. And I think sometimes the law of Moses gets a lot of bad PR because we have so much discussion in the Bible about the way the Jews kept the law of Moses, and the law comes in for so much bad publicity. I want to just go through a couple of things with you, that the law of Moses, oh, I can't get this to move, sorry. The law of Moses was given to regulate a nation of rescued slaves. And it says in the first of Timothy that the law was not made for a righteous man. And that's a significant statement that Paul makes. It was not to make a man righteous. It wasn't to prove that people were righteous. The law, when it was first given, was to regulate a nation of rescued slaves that had no worship code, very little civil structure, and it was to cut off the excesses of human nature, as you can read on the screen. So it covered every aspect of life. It actually went into all the aspects of life to do with health and with justice and with, you know, farming life and all the things that would happen in daily life. And the law was there to make sure that they regulated themselves according to the will of God. It was also in that law much things that could be learnt. They could actually learn many spiritual lessons that were there concealed in the worship code that they had. The law was given to be a positive thing. You know, God said in Deuteronomy 6, verse 24, it was for your good always, that he might preserve us alive as at this day. And so the law had a very much of a current application for living in the land. But we do notice that there wasn't one law that had a negative outcome for mankind. And that's important because everything God gave had a guarantee that it would actually be for their benefit, for their good. And so there were so many things that were designed to teach and inspire. For example, when you come to the health benefits, we know there were so many things in the law of Moses that today are recognized as being very good for the preservation of national health. The isolation of disease, the frequent washing of body and clothing, the avoidance of allergic and dangerous foods, proper sanitation, all of these things were regulated. God says, I will not bring the sicknesses of Egypt upon you if you keep my law. So included in the worship rituals were not only ways that God would be approached correctly, but there were many things that were designed for the health of the nation. And the Sabbath was another thing that was designed for their mental health, because left to ourselves, men would be tempted to actually work 7 days a week and give no time for God. There was a day set aside by God that they might focus at least one day a week on things that were of a spiritual nature and how they might show their concern for others. And so the Sabbath and the feast were built into that code that they might also have a proper balance in the way that they approach their life. It was a good law. And, you know, the Bible is very clear that it was, the law is good if a man use it lawfully, says Timothy. It's Romans 7 verse 12, the law is holy, the commandment holy, it's just and it's good. And that's why, of course, when the kingdom comes, much of the law of Moses will be reinstituted for the mortals of the age to come. Because it is a good law. It is a good way to teach people how to live correctly and to focus correctly upon God. That's how it should have been viewed. And God intended the Jews to see many things from that law. The law had expanded the promises to Abraham. Their role as a nation was to be examples to the rest of the world. They would see in the law that our nature is prone to sin and we need God's redemption and forgiveness. We need the one lamb that would come to finally cover sin. And as Paul points out in Galatians, the very fact that so often the law was hard to keep and that they end up being condemned by the law meant that they had to look beyond the law to have their faith in God's final salvation in the Messiah. So the law was intended to actually point them forward to Christ. The tragedy is that the law became an end in itself, because here was a law that was given that would actually only provisionally forgive. It was based on a future sacrifice being made. The blessings of this life were always for their good. Deuteronomy 4 verse 40, you shall keep for his statutes and his commandments, which I command thee this day, that it may go well with thee and thy children after thee. Thou mayest prolong thy days upon the earth, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee forever. And it was for their good always. So here was a law that was designed to be positive if viewed correctly. The problem we have, of course, is that by the time that Jesus came to the earth, there had been a dramatic shift in what God intended in the law of Moses to how it was now being interpreted by the current religious leaders of that time. And I want to make the point, it was not the law was at fault. It was a good, holy, just and good law. What had taken place by the time of Christ was a gross misapplication of the commandments and the statutes that God had given into a code of self-righteousness. And Jesus came up against several parties in the nation at this time that in the end he would have conflict that would lead to his death. So here are just a brief summary of the people that he had to come against. There were the scribes, also another group called lawyers, very similar, but they actually wrote out copies of the law and they defined the law. And as we know, by the time of Christ, they were starting to use interpretations of the law that were setting the law against itself, such as the horrid Corban law. There were the Pharisees who were separated themselves from others. Separated ones, as the word means, or the interpreters. And again, they were very close to the scribes. There were the Sadducees, and the Sadducees contained the priesthood. They were collaborating with Rome. They owned the priesthood and actually traded it amongst themselves. And they were very powerful, but they were also very worldly. And for them, it was so much about power as it was about religion. Including that were the chief priests, the influential high priests, because Rome used to cycle the priesthood around. It didn't just go until a priest died. They would sell it off to the highest bidder sometimes. And there were four families of the priestly aristocracy. And that's why you find characters like Annas being still influential, even though Caiaphas was the high priest at that particular time. Then we have the priests. Josephus tells us there were 100,000 of the priests at that time. They were all supported by the tithes and the offerings. The work was so limited that most priests only had their course for 2 weeks a year, plus they would add the 3 weeks of the feasts to that, which meant that most of the priests in the time of Christ were only working about 5 weeks a year. And that just gives you some idea of how the priesthood had been corrupted by not only the number of priests that they had, but the way that they had made themselves in that very, very favourable position. In fact, Josephus tells us that the priests had suffered a lot of illness through overindulgence and a very lazy lifestyle at the time of Christ. But they had a lot to lose, and that's why some of these people were very much opposed to Christ. I wanted to talk about the scribes, because it was through the scribes that a lot of this deviation from the good intention of the law came to pass. Being very aligned to the Pharisees, they studied the law and they turned God's principles, God's commandments, into further rules and regulations. And this is where the deviation from what God intended became serious. It was their job to actually define people how you kept the law. not enough just to have the fact that God gave 613 commandments. They decided that they would make this into an oral law or a scribal law, which was called the tradition of the elders. And so there was this tremendous overlay of additional information, additional ways, hedges and fences that were put around the law of Moses to make sure you could keep it as God required. And so a thing called the Mishnah came into being, which was 800 pages of definitions of the law of Moses. And then there were commentaries on the Mishnah. So all the different rabbis had their say, and that became the two Talmuds, which ended up being 72 volumes. And I just quote those figures to make the point that once you start going down the line of multiplying rules and regulations and putting it all in writing as they did, there's never an end to it, because you have to define every type of work as to whether or not it is a violation of the Sabbath or not. And every type of defilement had to be defined in precise terms. And this is where the law of Moses was totally misinterpreted and totally misapplied by the Jews of that time. And we just need to appreciate that it wasn't the law that God intended, that God set up for Israel. This was their interpretation of it. And as we know, much of that interpretation became quite devious. So the Ten Commandments had become a whole library of human definitions. And this is a quote from Josephus, that they actually had a view that it is more culpable to teach contrary to the precepts of the scribes than contrary to the law itself. And so you can see that there had been, the law of Moses had been superseded now by the use of all these scribal interpretations, and that's where it became very, very dangerous. And so that's why Jesus challenged them. He said, "You've made the commandment of God of none effect through your tradition. In vain did they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." And this is something we need to appreciate, that this wasn't just ignoring the Bible. This was actually putting a whole new raft of interpretations in place of the Bible. And that's why Jesus came in such definite contact with them. Now, with the Pharisees, because they occupy so much of the New Testament, we just need to be aware of them. Because if anything, there's a danger that can happen in zealous religion, it's that we can actually go down some of the paths of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees devoted themselves to keeping all the tribal traditions and interpretations. So they weren't just content to keep the law. They had to keep the traditions of the elders as well. That made them very cautious about having contact with anybody that may influence them or somehow defile them. So they were separate. They would not go in even when Jesus was on trial. They wouldn't go into the judgment hall of Pilate unless they defile themselves. So they kept away from sinners. Any activity that might detract from the observance of the tradition of the elders meant that they had to keep separating themselves, and they became therefore the separate ones. To them, religion became legalism. Ritual and externalism was all about how men saw you and the fact that you weren't defiled and that you could actually do the little things that the law required. As so often happens with human nature, when people are incredibly zealous for legal ritual, that becomes a matter of pride, because they are spending so much effort doing it that they look at others and say, well, they're not doing what I'm doing. And one of the greatest signs of Pharisaism is the fact that there is a constant comparing oneself to others who are viewed as less capable or less dedicated. So, for the Pharisee, true religion became the province of the expert and the professional worshipper. They were people who had, they thought, the best way to come to God. And they had the most incredible zeal. Saul was a Pharisee. And he said, you know, I was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. Incredibly zealous, but it was misguided and it was hypocritical. So these were the main people that Jesus had to come up against. And the Pharisees, of course, were very much on his case from day one. And that's why Jesus condemned the Pharisees. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. You notice he puts the two together, hypocrites. Why? Why did he condemn them? Well, they shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. And that was the fact that they said, unless people are as good as us, unless they do exactly what we say, then they're not in the kingdom of God. And Jesus said, you've actually got it wrong. You're not going in, but you're also keeping others out. And so the Pharisees came in for very, very strong condemnation from the Lord Jesus Christ. scathing denunciations. It's amazing when you just go through some of the context where Jesus had conflict with the Pharisees in particular. In Matthew 15, he says, you transgressed the commandment of God by your tradition. You made the commandment of God of none effect. You're hypocrites. Your heart is far from God. Teaching for doctrines, the commandments of men. He said, you're weeds in the garden of God that you'll be rooted up, and you're the blind leading the blind to destruction. And there's no doubt that the Lord Jesus Christ had tremendously severe things to say about the Pharisees. And, you know, it was because they were, in his eyes, the greatest problem he had in getting through to the Jewish people, because inevitably people looked at these Pharisees and thought, I wish we could be like them. And they had them in admiration, and Jesus had to get that feeling of admiration taken away from the eyes of the people. It's quite amazing when you read the Gospels how much conflict Jesus had with the religious authorities in comparison with the civil authorities. There's only one adverse reference to Herod, to the Herods, when he said that fox Herod in a conversation about the work of John. But there was no condemnation of the Roman government. You know, there was no condemnation of Pilate particularly. Jesus kept away from those political arguments. What he did do was to actually attack those who were very much into the commandments of men and actually had moved away from what God had said. And so he came in conflict with the Pharisees on many, many occasions. He said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Now that's interesting, because when you think about leaven, the whole significance of leaven is its quick corrupting influence. And Jesus said the leaven of the Pharisees, which was self-righteousness, had to be avoided. The leaven of the Sadducees, who were looking after their role and their power, was self-satisfaction. Avoid that. And the Herodians, who of course were very, very political people, had very little religious affinity with anything. They were about preserving their favored role in the shadow of Rome. So Jesus said, avoid the leaven of all these people, because they will corrupt you if you get in too much contact with them. So what was leaven about? Well, leaven is about the fact that it will actually lead to worse things. And Jesus is saying, beware of that leaven, because if you concede to their traditions, if you go along with their politics, if you follow their man-made laws to the nth degree as they want you to, it's a process of corruption that takes you further and further away from the words of God. And that's why he said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And perhaps the greatest example of that leaven was that the Sabbath day had been turned into a day where you did absolutely nothing if you could avoid it. And that just shows you that the total meaning of the Sabbath had been lost in the way that they were keeping it in those days. It was the same with the laws of defilement. Because the law had so many things where you could be defiled and became unclean, that was meant to teach you that there was always an uncleanness in human nature that we need to be concerned about, that we needed forgiveness always because we sin. And it was just to teach a moral lesson, beside the health benefits that came from the things they had to avoid. But to the Pharisees, being ceremonially clean became an important thing. So somehow God was honored if you were ceremonially clean. And it was the same with the Sabbath, that if on the Sabbath day you did absolutely nothing, then God was honored by you doing nothing. And it just shows you how perverse their interpretation of the law had become. So Jesus said, beware of the leaven, beware of the corrupting influence of this man-made law that has been overlaid over God's holy, just, and good law. So we come to the Sabbath day, and it's no wonder that this became the major battleground between Christ and the Jewish authorities. They both chose this battleground. On the first occasion in Mark chapter 3, we find that they set him up with a confrontation on the Sabbath. They brought the man with a withered hand into the synagogue when Jesus was teaching and put the man right in front of him. So they said, we're going to make the Sabbath a battleground. After that, Jesus also took on and made the Sabbath a battleground, because it was the greatest example of how the law had been misinterpreted by them. So what was the Sabbath really designed to do? Well, Isaiah makes it very clear, and these are very familiar verses to us. Is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry and bring thy poor to the cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, you cover him, and you hide not yourself from thine own flesh. And God makes it abundantly clear that the whole point of the Sabbath was not to do nothing in order to glorify God. It was an opportunity to stop doing what you do every day of the week, to stop thinking about commerce and agriculture and the things that take up daily life, and to actually make it an opportunity to get out and to do some positive things for our brethren and sisters, and particularly for those who are less fortunate. And that's what the day was designed to do. That's what the fasting day was designed to do, not to sit in a corner in sackcloth and ashes. And Isaiah goes on in verse 13, if you turn away your foot from the Sabbath as you keep it, from doing thy pleasure, in other words, doing nothing, you call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of Yahweh. Honorable is your honor him, not doing your own ways, not finding your own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words. Then he goes on to say, you should delight thyself in Yahweh, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken it. And the Sabbath was designed to be a day that would lead them to think of the great things of God and the great things of God's future when he will bring the Sabbath of rest to the earth in the millennium. And they should have been thinking about those things and going out to help their brethren to actually lift their minds towards the great things of God. And God says, that's what I wanted the Sabbath to be. What a tragedy they made it a day of doing absolutely nothing. And that's so obvious when you go and look at what the Mishnah said about the Sabbath. And remember, the Mishnah was not the Bible. The Mishnah was the scribal interpretations of the Bible. So this is how they corrupted the Sabbath law by their tradition. So they actually identified 39 different categories of work that had to be forbidden on the Sabbath. And especially when you actually created something, you actually made something, that was particularly offensive to the Jews. So then they made rules about avoiding work. So they're called the halakot, thousands of definitions, which as modern technology comes along with new devices, they have to keep adding to that definitions of whether, you know, is touching a mouse on a computer going to be another definition that has to be added to? Is that work? How many clicks on your computer can you have? So they're constantly adding to this because different kinds of work are being identified. And we have a couple of examples just to show how ridiculous it was. On the Sabbath, on the sunset before the Sabbath, you had to put your needle down just in case you might inadvertently pick up a needle and move it on the Sabbath. And that's work. And therefore you've broken the Sabbath and somehow you've dishonored God. And it just gives you some idea how this whole huge raft of legislation was added to what God intended the Sabbath to be. I love this one about not searching for fleas, because while you might be searching for fleas, you might adjust the wick on your lamp and that would be work. So, but you know, candlelight was permissible because you couldn't adjust it. It just shows you how intricate it got with trying to define things. And then there were the arguments about wearing and carrying. Is a hair clip being carried or worn? And you know, you couldn't even wear a wig in the public streets. So it was just some of these crazy things they got down to. And just extreme cases like this. You probably heard the one about chickens laying eggs on the Sabbath. But the point of it was that in the end, the Sabbath became such a weighted down with their man-made definitions. And for them, it became important that these things should be observed. Well, interesting that some things they actually had to define further that were not in the law of Moses. I mean, you don't find in the law of Moses the limits on travel on the Sabbath. They had to make different laws for the city and the country people because of the circumstances they were in. So again, they got to define these things. The mutzkah, the things which became off limit, and this is a very common thing with overzealous people, is that you get this making sure we don't accidentally fall into sin. So we build hedges. We build another fence one step further away from the law. So you don't even touch a hammer on the Sabbath because you might actually move it or pick it up. And therefore you might tap something and you've actually done work. So you keep away from all tools on the Sabbath. And it just gets so, so intricate in trying to work out how you can keep all these laws when you put it down in writing the way that they did. So they got very extreme. This is why Jesus chose the Sabbath as the battleground when he came in conflict with them. Amazingly, though, as Jesus pointed out, as we read in Matthew, that they had to make exemptions to the Sabbath law that, again, were not in the Bible. They said, well, if somebody's really sick, they can be attended to. And even today, Jewish doctors can attend the sick, but when they go, they have to start their car with a different hand of what they normally do, write the prescription with a different hand of what they normally do, just to make the point that they're actually keeping the Sabbath in some way, even though they're attending the sick. And it just shows you again how this legal mind gets so entangled in its own logic and its own laws. But people were sick on the Sabbath day and they had to be looked after. And animals were valuable in an agricultural society. If your ox is fallen into a pit, you're not going to leave it there until the next day. Animals needed to be watered and fed because their health depended on it. So they had exemptions that they made of the Sabbath law for economic reasons. And it just shows you, of course, that this whole path of trying to overdefine things had become problematical in itself. It was common sense to attend the sick. It was common sense to look after your animals. But it didn't mean that you were actually going back to doing your regular daily commerce if you actually gave your animals some water and feed on the Sabbath day. And they had recognized this. And there was some, as Jesus pointed out, there was some terrific variations within their own code. You couldn't pick up a needle, but you could actually go and get an ox out of a pit. And if you ever tried to get an animal that's got bogged in a pond or a creek or a mud puddle, there is probably nothing more exhausting than trying to lift a big animal out of a mud hole or a pit or a creek. But they said you could do that because you needed the ox. And it just shows you how much they had gone down that path. And yet when Jesus cured a woman who had had an infirmity for many, many years, he cured that woman of her spinal problem, they criticized him for healing woman on the Sabbath. And you just get an idea of how much it was in contrast to their own exemptions. We know, of course, that circumcision was an exemption against the Sabbath. And it just shows you how that this over-definition had become a problem in itself. The problem for the way they kept the Sabbath was the less you did, the more holy you became. And therefore, by doing less and less, you could not do any good. And that had completely reversed the intention of the Sabbath. So Jesus chose to make the Sabbath a battleground because of the way that they had made it such a disaster. And it was a very interesting way that Jesus now began to provoke them about the Sabbath. There were many times in the early part of Jesus' ministry where he healed thousands on one day. We read about the day they came up the mountain, and it says he healed them all. But as the ministry unfolded, the Lord became much more selective in the miracles that he did. And we find that in the end, he was deliberately performing miracles on the Sabbath day. What is interesting about the Sabbath day healings the Lord performed was that not one of them needed to be done that day. All of them were not life-threatening. All of them could have waited till the next day for Jesus to heal the blind, the lame, the woman that had the spinal problem. All of those things could have been done the next day. And yet Jesus very deliberately decided to provoke the authorities by healing on the Sabbath day when it wasn't absolutely necessary. So here are the seven confrontations that Jesus had with the Jews over the Sabbath. And the first three happened in Capernaum. So we have the demoniac in the synagogue where Jesus was there teaching, and this man just shouted out and Jesus cured him on the spot. And that, of course, alerted the authorities that he was willing to cure on the Sabbath. Peter's mother-in-law probably was done privately at home, but word would have got out that it was a Sabbath day on which he was healed. So the challenge in Mark chapter 3 was that I want you to come to Mark chapter 3 because this was a very deliberate setup by the authorities in the synagogue at Capernaum. And bear in mind that very likely the ruler of the synagogue was Jairus. And in the parable Jesus used on this day was about the one sheep. And later on, we have Jairus with one only daughter. And you can connect that up with the parable of Nathan to David about one sheep, one daughter. It was as a daughter to him. This was perhaps the beginning of Jairus starting to think, because he would have been party to organizing this challenge to Jesus that took place in the synagogue at Capernaum, as we read in Mark chapter 3. So he entered again in verse 1 to the synagogue, and there was a man that had a withered hand, and they watched him. And we get the impression that all the authorities were there sitting around, because in verse 6, the Pharisees went straight out, got together with the Herodians, who they despised on most occasions, who they could never usually work with because they were political. They were in Rome's pocket. But the Pharisees and the Herodians get together to destroy Jesus. So this was a confrontation they set up to actually prove to the people that Jesus would break the Sabbath, and therefore they would have him disgraced in the eyes of the people. So this was their confrontation. And so Jesus, and it says in verse 2, they did it that they might accuse him. So it's a very deliberate setup. So Jesus challenges them first. Before he actually heals the man, he says, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day? And of course, they would not answer the question. And when people will not answer a question, it's almost always an admission of guilt. They're trying to hide something. They would not answer that question. And this is one of the few occasions it reads that Jesus was angry. Now, we know he was angry when he cleansed the temple on two occasions, but he was an occasion in the synagogue where it tells us that Jesus was angry. And this is divine anger. This is not personal anger. This is divine anger, because their hard hearts were on show. They wouldn't answer his question. So he did what would actually make them ashamed, and that was he healed the man. Now, you think about this. This wasn't a case of somebody who might have had a mental illness suddenly becoming calm, or somebody who was blind saying, now I see, when you couldn't see the physical change. This was a man with a hand that was withered up like a claw. And the hand was in front of everybody, obviously, you know, very distorted, very wasted away. And this hand now becomes a perfectly good hand in front of their eyes. It has to be a miracle. You know, it's not something where you can actually undo perhaps some deficiency in the brain, even in something that might have been caused by a fall that another fall can reverse. You know, we know there are those sort of things that can happen when people get healed very suddenly. But this was a very visible hand that actually changed in front of their eyes. And that's why, you know, their reaction to this was so appalling, that they went out, joined with the Herodians that they might destroy him, because they couldn't deny the miracle. It had happened right in front of their eyes. And it just shows you the hardness of their hearts. And maybe this was the beginning of Jairus starting to think, but for the time being, the authorities were totally determined to destroy him. So that was Mark chapter 3. When we come to the remaining miracles, notice the first three were in Capernaum. What is fascinating about the rest of them is Jesus now takes the confrontation to the heart of the Jewish nation. So the last four challenges on the Sabbath day, 38 years, the man paralyzed 38 years in Jerusalem, that's the pool of Bethesda. The woman with 18 years infirmity near Judea, near Jerusalem, we're told. The man with dropsy is in the city of Jerusalem in Luke chapter 14. And then finally, the Lord goes right into the temple in Jerusalem with the man born blind. And he's in the courts of the temple. And he's actually taken this confrontation, this deliberate provocation, because none of these were life-threatening in diseases. He's taken the confrontation right into the heart of Jewish worship in their temple, and to show them he's not only Lord of the temple, but he's Lord of the Sabbath. And he's actually taken it right home to them. So it's amazing, isn't it, that this is now taken to the heart of the Jewish nation. So I want you to come with me to John chapter 9, because this last one is particularly significant. Now, we know the record of John chapter 9, that we have the man that was born blind, and he goes through the debate, which it seems like it was actually done in his presence, which is pretty insensitive on the part of the disciples about whether this man's a sinner or his parents were, which of course was another Jewish fable that somehow people were born a certain way because of their parents. Even the disciples were still struggling with that concept. And we know the story that Jesus actually cured this man, put the clay on his eyes, went through a process where the man's faith was invigorated, required him to walk still blind at the pool of Siloam to wash the clay off, and then the man, of course, came back. But I want to pick it up in verse 15. Because when the Pharisees interview this man, they have some grievances with him. They asked him how he'd received his sight. He said to them, "He put clay upon mine eyes and washed, and I do see." And here's a man that they all knew that had been there for many, many years in the temple. His family was known by everybody. And yet he was now seeing clearly. And they were faced with a miracle. And the man says, "I just washed the clay off and now I can see." And you can imagine, can't you, what a confrontation this was for the Pharisees, that right in their temple this had been done. And here was the man now coming back to the temple courts and saying to them, as we know the argument goes on, they challenge his parents, they disown him. Everybody doesn't want to stand up for him against these religious leaders. But in the end, the man makes a very subtle point. He says, "You know, if this man's a sinner, I wouldn't have my sight." And he just points out the blatantly obvious, that somehow this man has some power they will not recognize. But look at verse 16. This actually clarifies the strange way of thinking that these Pharisees had. And they said this: "This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day." And here they are faced with the seventh miracle that's happened on a Sabbath day. Could very well be some of those Pharisees in Mark chapter 3 had seen the withered hand. They'd seen the man carrying his bed. They'd seen the man at the pool of Bethesda walking and leaping with his restored health. How could they say that all of these miracles are void and not of God because they were done on a Sabbath day? And it's just incredible to think that they just could not get their heads around the fact that they had been challenged on that day. And therefore they rejected the obvious power that was in front of their eyes. And that just shows you how far they had gone away from what God's law intended to be. How much they misunderstood the purpose of the Sabbath. That it was a day for doing good and for curing and helping and encouraging people. And here they were now condemning a man, casting him out of the synagogue, because he stood by Jesus and said, "Well, all I know is he gave me my sight on the Sabbath day." And just pointing out the simple logic that a man who can do these miracles cannot be a sinner. So here is the final confrontation. This is the way that they have now decided to get rid of Jesus. And we know, of course, that in the record from this point onwards, they were very determined to enlist the help of Judas and to get Jesus crucified. So this is just some indication, isn't it, of the battle that Jesus had with the Jews over the Sabbath. And we could go through all the different instances, but I think the stories are fully well known. What is important here is the Lord's anger with this mindset. If you come to the end of John chapter 9, and he said this: "For judgment I am come," verse 39, of John chapter 9, "for judgment I am come into the world, that they which see not might see." So Jesus was opening the eyes of people who were unable to see the things of God because they had had the veil cast out of their eyes by the leaders that they had. So he was actually making people who were not seeing to see. And that they which see, those who claim they see, might be blind. And this very challenge that Jesus was doing miracles in their temple on the Sabbath day, and that they could not accept it, would actually make them more blind than they were before. And that's why the Pharisees reacted in verse 40. They said, "Are we blind also? Are you calling us blind?" And Jesus said to them in verse 41, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But because you say, 'We see,' therefore your sin remaineth." And this was the Lord Jesus saying to these people that we are completely incompatible. You think because you have all this wisdom, all this knowledge, all these laws, that somehow you see better than other people, and yet you are as blind can be. And so He had no time for that mindset. And when we see the anger the Lord expresses towards the Pharisees on so many occasions, we have to be very cautious that we don't ever fall into that mindset of putting man-made laws in front of the laws of God and making them the end in themselves and ignoring the big things. In that wonderful parable of the Pharisee and the publican, Jesus made several very potent points. The Pharisee kept he fasted twice in a week. That's probably 100 times more than God required him to fast. He was keeping things like the tithing the herbs of the field and regarding that as his righteousness. But the worst thing about the Pharisee was he judged himself to be good because he was not like the other man, the publican, standing by. And the great tragedy of people who actually live by laws, as the Jews did in those days, was that they become very much comparative to other people. And the Pharisee, of course, was, as Jesus said, ended up praying with himself because God wasn't listening. So never let us think that avoiding things or doing nothing makes us of value to God. There are many things in life that we wisely do avoid. We don't want to be tempted because our human nature is easily led away into sin. There are many things we don't do because we want to respect the conscience of our brethren and sisters, and therefore we don't lead them into paths of sin where they might have a weakness. There are many things that we don't do because there is a common benefit in seeking peace and harmony in our ecclesias. There are places we don't go. There are practices we don't undertake because they might lead us to sin. But all of those things are not an end in themselves. They are not making us acceptable in God's eyes in themselves. They are all matters of expediency. There are matters of wisdom that we perform that we might do the things that really do matter. You see, God is not glorified in the things that we don't do. Jesus teaches us God is glorified in the things that we do do, the positive things we do, in the encouraging things we do, in the things where we're lifting people up, in the things where we are reinforcing people in their faith, in our preaching and bringing more people to God, in our caring for our brethren and sisters in their times of distress. These are the positive things that are of value to God. And while we wisely keep away from many things that might be of danger to us, they are never our righteousness in themselves. So, Jesus could say to the Pharisees, yes, you make the tithes of mint and anise and cumin, but you've actually forgotten about mercy and faith and love and reaching out to others as he was doing. So let's not fall for the trap of the Pharisees of keeping traditions of men. It's very well expressed in Weymouth's translation of Colossians chapter 2 verse 20. And bear in mind, this is not saying that the law of Moses was bad. It was saying that the Jewish interpretations of the law, the Jewish focus on minor things, had become a great danger to spirituality. And so in writing to the Colossians about the need for them to resist the inroads of Judaism in the ecclesial world, he said this: do not submit to such preceptors, do not handle this. That's the fence, isn't it? Do not taste that, do not touch the other thing. Referring to things which are to be used and perish, in obedience to mere human rulings and injunctions and teachings. So these criticisms that are made in the New Testament are against the human rulings and injunctions and teachings that came from the Mishnah and the Talmud. They were not against the law of Moses as it should have been understood. These rules have indeed an appearance of wisdom where self-imposed worship exists and an affectation of humility and ascetic severity. But none of them are any value in combating the indulgence of our lower natures. And it is a sad fact that when people live by law and by fences and by hedges and by doing nothing, that it actually is opening up other avenues for the natural sinful nature to take over. And what we need to realize is that the very best way to defeat sin is not by law, it's by positive displacement. As Brother Carter said, sublimation is better than repression. as Paul said, overcome evil with good. And it's in the positive things that we do. It's in the preaching we undertake. It's in the caring we undertake. It's in the encouraging we undertake that we will actually do far more to actually stop sin coming into our lives than living by a mindset of laws and regulations that will always leave an avenue for sin to come back. So let's be very careful, brethren and sisters, that we actually have the correct attitude towards keeping the ways of God. There are many concerns that we're facing today in our brotherhood. The world is putting incredible pressure upon our members to conform to its postmodern thinking. Perhaps the greatest thing that concerns me at the moment is the tendency to lose the uniqueness of the truth and the value of the fact that the one true gospel is the mechanism that God uses to select those who are his saints. We need to defend these things. There is a great need for us to defend divine morality that is under great challenge from the world, to defend clear scriptural doctrine that is under challenge from this concept of, well, doctrine doesn't really matter. So let's make sure that we're actually putting our efforts into fighting those issues which are clearly scriptural. Let's not be diverted into, you know, these Jewish type laws where we end up debating things that really are of no profit. There are so many challenges that we can actually deal with the things of divine morality, of the correct doctrine for the truth, and never ever get into the mindset that the Jews did, that they were making themselves valuable to God by doing nothing or by keeping themselves totally uncorrupted from any defilement. The correct attitude is found in Luke chapter 17 and verse 10. I'd like you to come with me and let's just finish there in Luke 17 and verse 10. There are many things that we do. There are lots of things that we do in service to our brethren and sisters and out of respect for ecclesial peace and harmony. But Jesus said this in verse 10 of Luke chapter 17. So likewise ye, when you have done all these things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We've done that which is our duty to do. So, yes, we do live by God's commandments, by God's laws, but in the end, it's what we do in a positive sense beyond that in imitating God, in the way that we help our brethren and sisters, the way we proclaim his word, that really is what God requires of us. And as Micah said, what is it that God requires of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? Brethren and sisters, that's the challenge of the legal mind that Jesus had to contend with. Let's make sure that we're actually fighting the right issues, the morality of God, the doctrines of God, and that we actually give all of our efforts to caring for our brethren and sisters in these most difficult times. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Ron. Appreciate your help this evening. So as we close our class tonight, we'll have a prayer with Brother Chad Monahan of the Largo Ecclesia in Florida. After we sing hymn 406, and then after we're all finished, then we'll have the announcements for the evening. So hymn 406 is an evening hymn, and this is reading from the final verse there. I fear no foe with thee at hand to bless. Ills have no weight and tears no bitterness. Where is death's sting? Where grave thy victory? I triumph still if thou abide with me. Hymn 406. Thank you.
Our great and awesome God, our Father in heaven, your word is amazing. It is filled with your wisdom, and you keep offering it us to us for instruction. We thank you for opening it up to us today, having it read and shared with us by brethren who search out its message. We come to the end of this evening thankful for these opportunities we've had today to be reminded of how we can and must bring you glory and honor, even though we fail. So we seek your help to keep trying. We look forward to tonight's rest and pray you will refresh us for another day tomorrow filled with these lessons and encouragement and fellowship and love. We come to you tonight through the only way provided, the way opened by your Son, who's our King, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.